This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, Bud Selig, the commissioner of Major League Baseball, looked back on what he and the Players Association had accomplished since appearing before Congress, and he felt that it was good.
When we walked out of the hearing on March 17th, if somebody had told you that on November 17th you'd be announcing the toughest steroid program in American sports, you probably could have gotten some pretty good odds.
The program to which the commissioner refers would tag a player testing positive for steroids for the first time with a 50-game suspension. A second offense would idle a player for 100 games, and a third would invoke a lifetime ban, appealable after 2 years. Perhaps more remarkable is that this week, baseball instituted penalties for players using amphetamines, the so-called greenies and beans that some say have been as common in clubhouses as chewing tobacco, bubblegum, and sunflower seeds. Beginning in the spring, players testing positive for amphetamines will be subject to additional testing, and players failing a second test will be suspended for 25 games. Commissioner Selig learned about amphetamines from the experts.
When I met with the team doctors, 10 team doctors and 4 trainers, and they spent most of their time talking about amphetamines, they were very blunt in their assessment of not only the numbers of people going on, but the seriousness of it.
Dr. Charles Yousalis, a professor of health and human development at Penn State University, who's been studying performance-enhancing drugs for 30 years, is one of the people who's been calling on baseball to address its amphetamine addiction.
The medical evidence as to their danger relative to steroids, I think, as the kids say, is a no-brainer. We have far more evidence that amphetamines are very dangerous. They're highly addictive. They can kill you, you know, acutely on the spot, create heart attack, strokes, and so on.
Though happy that Major League Baseball has finally acknowledged the presence of amphetamines as part of the game's culture for at least the past 40 years, Dr. Yousalis is dubious about the policy announced this week. He doesn't believe baseball or any other sport should be policing itself.
When there's a totally disinterested third parties acting as police, as judge, as jury, as executioner, as the Supreme Court, that's transparent. And anything less than that, the specter of the fox guarding the hen house raises its head.
One of the most energetic investigators following baseball's evolving drug policies has been ESPN's Sean Assale. I asked Mr. Assale whether he was familiar with the scope of amphetamine use among Major League Baseball players.
No, but I think that we've seen some quite startling incremental pieces of information come out. In the House Government Reform Committee report on Rafael Palmeiro and their investigation into whether to charge him with perjury, they ultimately decided not to. But one of the drop-dead details in there was that amphetamines are such a constant part of the clubhouse culture that some players are afraid to drink the coffee for fear that it's spiked with amphetamines. So I think it's an endemic part of the game.
Why are the penalties then so slight?
Well, I mean, you know, they really almost had a nuclear confrontation with the union over steroids, and the union ultimately gave. I think you could only fight on so many fronts with the union without risking, you know, another labor stoppage. I mean, you know, literally, the union gave on steroids in the theory that perhaps a small number of people, would really, really be affected. And I think that the union was worried that a vast number would be affected with amphetamines. The union was going to give on steroids. I don't think the union was going to give that much ground on amphetamines.
Are we talking about the kind of issue that might provoke a labor stoppage here?
Well, I think if baseball decided to go as strongly at amphetamines as they did at steroids, yes. I mean, the union sensed that it was fighting at least a losing public relations battle. And while that may not usually matter to the union, it seemed to this time there was a feeling that they should have just let Congress enact the legislation that it was threatening to, because that legislation may ultimately have been found to be unconstitutional. But did the union really want to go through that long and drawn-out process and have itself vilified with respect to steroids? No. I think that they might have, though, had baseball decided to push so strongly on amphetamines.
But it seems inevitable that the approach to the amphetamine business is similar to the beginning of the approach to the steroid business. We're going to go down the same road, aren't we, eventually, with worse penalties even for the first positive test?
You know, I mean, this is being driven by public outrage, at least with respect to steroids. And they've been, you know, you start to see parents of kids who have died or presumably have died based in some part on their steroid use. You have parents sort of standing up and saying enough is enough. That drives Congress, which then drives the sport leagues. I'm not sure you see that level of outrage with amphetamines. If you do, I think that you'll see it begin to dominate the same way. But it's strange. I just don't think you see speed treated the same way as you see the steroids treated.
You've done a lot of work in this area. I'm going to ask for an opinion now. Given the history of athletes staying ahead of drug tests, is it really possible to keep performance-enhancing drugs out of baseball or any other sport?
No. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're not talking about keeping it out of baseball. We're talking about or sports. We're talking about the prevalence of it. I believe that scandal is treated in a cost-benefit analysis, and at the point at which scandal becomes more expensive than the cost of fighting it or ending it, that's when you begin to see results. So I think that there's some sort of an economic model here where the sports have decided that they can tolerate only so much cheating, and then, you know, before it becomes economically costly. So they attempt to contain cheating, not stop it, but contain it. And so what we're looking for here is a broad level of deterrence with, I suspect, a ability to tolerate a small amount of boutique cheating.
People are throwing the term amphetamines around. As it's being used in the press and as it's being used by the people talking about testing, it must cover a very wide range of stimulants.
Yeah, I mean, again, I haven't sort of looked at WADA's stimulant list for the new calendar year, but I mean, it's everything from ephedrine-related products to, you know, dexedrine to stuff that used to be called Uptime and Greenies. I mean, it's anything that will elevate your heart rate beyond you know, a certain level. And they're serious about it. I mean, certainly in track, you worry about, you know, people hyperventilating and you know, you have people out there we've seen now in the NBA with heart arrhythmias playing. I mean, you know, they're worried that they may have people literally dropping dead before the fans.
Among the many journalists exploring this story has been Gwen Knapp of the San Francisco Chronicle. In a column this week, she maintained that she wasn't especially worried that Major League Baseball might not be testing for every possible stimulant.
That isn't even as big a concern for me as the fact that they haven't said how many tests they're going to do in the off season. They haven't said that once they do the off season testing, they're going to release how many tests they did. That says to me that they don't get it, that they don't get the fact that you have to release those numbers. It's what happens at the Olympic level, so that there's at least the appearance that you're really policing this. And the second thing is they would not specify how many tests someone can miss in the off season. Dodging these tests is a way of making sure that you get tested on a day when you've cleaned out your system. And if you aren't even willing to say, yes, we're going to make sure that that loophole is closed, which they weren't. They weren't willing to say it. In fact, they almost chided the reporter who even asked the question. I don't know if that's naivete or willful naivete or just, hey, we're doing a great PR thing here. Don't get in the way of it by asking the questions, you know, about the details that really, really matter.
It really sounds like the latter. It sounds as if they're doing the best they can to construct the impression that they're really dealing with this problem while perhaps recognizing that they can't.
They can do a lot more. One of the things that surprised me about all this is that I raised the issue in the column of fining the owners. That would certainly be a deterrent. You don't have to get approval from the union for it. And it's a new approach. I mean, we've always dealt with Olympic sports where the athletes basically work for themselves. Although I will say this, in USA Swimming, not in USA Swimming, in international swimming, if a country has a certain number of positive drug tests in a certain time frame, their entire country will be banned from international competition. So that's putting the onus on the people who are in charge of the sport to make sure that it stays clean. Because otherwise you have people saying, yeah, we're going to punish you if you get caught with this. But the people who are really in charge could be winking, nodding, saying, you go ahead and do whatever you have to do to perform for me. And the advantage of finding the owners would be at least you'd have to be worried that your boss's money is on the line when you do this. So your boss may not approve so much.
What do you suppose would happen if Major League Baseball, just to pick one of the leagues, were to take your advice and announce, okay, from now on, if a New York Yankee tests positive, it's going to cost George Steinbrenner $225,000?
Well, I recommended $500,000 for the first time. I think it should be a big, big fine. And if you have two guys test positive, it should be even bigger. And by the third test, it should be up to $5 million. I mean, I can't imagine them actually doing that. And that's because they don't, all along the owners have been able to say, we care so much about this, we really want it done. They have not put a single thing on the line. When they have negotiated in the contracts and the seasons when they've done contract negotiations, the owners have never said, we'll give up on revenue issues, we'll give up on revenue sharing, we'll give up on things that make us money in return for you giving us drug testing. And I think Congress should have demanded that. Congress should have said, if the union's standing in the way, then give them something. You know, put more money into the pension fund. Give them something tangible to agree to this. And that didn't happen. And if you don't hold the people at the top accountable, how are you really going to stop something? The only advantage of this is that it's good enough PR so that some really young kids may hear it and say, wow, Major League Baseball disapproves of people taking these things, so I'm not going to try it.
Gwen Knapp's suggestion that owners should be heavily fined when players in their employ test positive for banned drugs is unlikely to get much support from people like Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig, an ex-owner employed at the whim of current owners. The fact that baseball's new drug policy and the problems that inspired it were in the news this week does not mean baseball is the only sport with a drug problem, at least according to Dr. Charles Yousalis. So in the interest of providing a context for our consideration of baseball's circumstances and turning, albeit briefly, to a sport that's in season, we asked Dr. Yousalis for his opinion on the National Football League's policy regarding amphetamines.
You're tested one time a year, and you know when it's going to be. It's going to be a training camp. And I would suspect that if somebody was dumb enough to flunk that test, they probably couldn't remember the plays in their playbook and would lose their job anyway.
It remains to be seen how often Major League Baseball will test its players and how much advance notice the players will have. These are among the questions, along with which clubs have secured the most effective pitchers, hitters, and general managers, that will carry into spring training in just a few months. It's 19 minutes. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, sea urchins, orcas, and seals on wheels. Oh, my. But first, tomorrow in Florida, the boys of NASCAR will drive fast and turn left for the final time this season. It'll be the last trip around the track for Rusty Wallace and the end of the last full-time season for Ironman Ricky Rudd. But enough of the old guys. Joining me on the line is Matt Crossman, who writes about all sports motor-related for the Sporting News. Matt, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me on again.
Tony Stewart is 52 points ahead of his closest competition going into tomorrow's Ford 400 at Homestead Miami Speedway. A ninth-place finish or better will guarantee him the season's championship. Stewart's been extremely consistent all year long, so should we just start engraving his name on the Nextel Cup right now?
I would. Of course, it's not my trophy to have to re-engrave, but I certainly think he's the favorite. If you look at his career, you know, he's been racing on, you know, high-pressure national circuits, you know, since before he could legally drive on the street, and he's won national championships in eight different kinds of cars, and none of his competitors can match that, and his car has been so much faster than everybody else's that I'll be stunned if he doesn't win it.
It's also something about going into a race knowing you don't have to be any better than ninth. Maybe you can be a little more cautious than you might otherwise be.
You can. That's a good point. And if you look at some of his stats, you know, in the last 10 races, he has finished, actually in the last 22 races, he has finished worse than ninth a sum total of twice. So he's, you know, he's in pretty good position. The race last Sunday in Arizona, he like had a decent car but not great, and they debated whether they should try to make it better, and ultimately they said, we're good enough as we are, let's not mess with it. And he ended up finishing fourth, and he said, you know, if we would have messed with it, yeah, maybe we could have won, but we also could have finished 15th. So he's already shown evidence of thinking long-term, and he's not going to do anything stupid in this race. He's going to race as cautiously as he can. He's going to be fine.
Technically, three drivers are within striking distance of Stewart: Jimmy Johnson, Carl Edwards, and Greg Biffle. Which of those three has the best chance of catching him?
I think you'd have to say Jimmy Johnson, because if you look at Carl Edwards and Greg Biffle, they would need both Johnson and Stewart to have really bad days, and then they would have to have a good day on top of that. So that's a whole another factor. But Johnson, as good as he has been, and he has been basically historically good, this is his fourth season, and in his other three, he's finished fifth, second, and second, which is basically unprecedented in modern NASCAR. But, you know, finishing second three times in a row is either spectacular if you're his fan, or if you're not, you start to think, that's a little soft to finish second 3 years in a row. So I guess that makes me think that Johnson is not going to be able to catch him, Johnson will take the extra chance and it'll backfire.
I'm going to ask for your help here with something. I thought that since Jeff Gordon didn't qualify for the chase for the Cup, we wouldn't be hearing much more about him this season. But now I read that he's in contention for the number 11 spot for the season, which has a $1 million payout. So under this new system, is it better to come in 11th than 10th?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, it's a runner-up situation that NASCAR sort of tacked on when they did this new point system so that, you know, there would be something to talk about other than the top 10. I mean, a $1 million bonus, and I can't believe I'm going to say something like this, but $1 million doesn't mean very much to Jeff Gordon. I mean, his career earnings and his career, you know, salary and his net worth, it's more than 100. So to him, he's more concerned about, you know, winning, you know, getting lined up for 2006. And, you know, the top 10 guys will all get more than $1 million for finishing in their positions. So, you know, it's sort of like taking you took the prom queen to the prom, but it was your sister.
He had already been eliminated from contention, but last year's champion, Kurt Busch, has now been suspended by his team from the last two races of the season. What's worse here, the fact that a driver was pulled over on suspicion of drunk driving, the fact that the driver is the reigning champion, or the fact that the driver, and we're still talking about Kurt Busch, is partially sponsored by Crown Royal Whiskey?
I think it's the last one that got him in the most trouble. As it turns out, some of the initial reporting about the incident was wrong, and the allegations of drunk driving were sort of, I mean, they weren't accurate. He took a test. There was alcohol in his system, but it was about 25% of what you would need to sort of be illegal, if you will. So he blew .017, nowhere near the threshold of drunk driving in the state of Arizona. However, as a spokesman for, you know, an anti-drunk driving campaign, the fact that he had one drop in his blood system is really, I think that's what got him fired. And you can see from Crown Royal's perspective, if they're going to pay somebody to be, you know, actively against drunk driving, that person cannot. I mean, basically, Busch had the equivalent of perhaps a glass of wine with dinner and then drove home and got pulled over. Nobody else would get fired for that, but the fact that he was, you know, a spokesman for an anti-drunk driving campaign, that cost him his job.
Matt Crossman covers NASCAR for the Sporting News. Matt, thank you very much for joining me.
Thanks again for having me.
The contiguous 48 may have NASCAR, but Alaska has the Humpy 500. Each October, elementary school drivers gather in the fishing port of Petersburg, Alaska, to race gravity-powered go-karts downhill past the town's largest salmon cannery. The Humpy 500 has become a popular tradition in this town of about 3,200 as residents wind down from a busy salmon fishing season. Matt Lichtenstein of station KFSK in Petersburg was present for the 11th Humpy 500, and he has this report.
As the southeast Alaska rain drizzles outside, nine race teams wait for a final safety check of their go-karts in a Quonset hut at Petersburg Fisheries Incorporated, which sponsors the Humpy 500. Patrick Wilson is plant manager.
Some great designs here, so it looks like some families and friends and kids got together and did a great job getting ready. So it's going to be a lot of fun. I hope people get down and see this thing.
A small but enthusiastic crowd of about 100 people turned out to cheer on the racers and see their unique kart designs. At the staging area, a purple-wigged princess named Catherine Cardenas stands beside her wheels.
My kart is a purple princess sea urchin.
And tell me how you made it. Look at this, all these foam spikes coming out of there.
One of my dad's friends drilled holes in it, and then we sticked foam things into it.
tell me what your thoughts are just before you get ready for the race.
I hope I don't crash.
Some drivers are rookies, others are veterans, like Chelsea Tigner, whose team is dressed in white suits with plastic feathers to match the giant bird she's driving.
My cart's name is the Gull. It took us about 2 weeks to make it. We paper machined the head, and most of the other bodywork was from the last go-kart last year's SpongeBob.
So are you excited to go down the hill this year? You have any strategies?
Yeah, I'm excited to go down the hill this year, and I'm going to try not to hold on the brakes as long as I did last year.
The carts are built around 55-gallon drums with a variety of wheel types, brake systems, and bicycle parts. The Humpy 500 is named in honor of the pink salmon, nicknamed Humpy for the hump that develops on the back of spawning males. The Humpy is an important part of the salmon catch. Millions are canned at local fish processors each summer. Naming a race after a fish is natural for a town that depends on the seafood haul from hundreds of small family-run fishing operations, and the race itself has become a tradition for many local families.
And are the drivers ready? Looks like you're doing the last few-minute checks.
While her dad, Mark, makes some final adjustments, 8-year-old Adrian DeSillo is strapped into a giant shark with silver sides, sharp teeth around the hood, and 2 CDs for eyes.
It's my first time driving, and the name of it is Dashy, and it's a great white shark. I made these eyes up here, and I made these little designs like this.
I see your dad is adjusting the brakes right now. Are you making them tighter there?
Yeah, as tight as I can get them.
And they're off the starting gate.
Over the years, organizers have made a number of changes to increase safety. Carts must have good rear brakes and welded roll bars. Drivers have to wear harnesses, gloves, and helmets.
Put the brakes on? Only when you need it, okay?
Kathy Batman is safety coordinator for Petersburg Fisheries. She makes a few suggestions to the racers as they sit on the starting ramp. Batman has been doing this just about as long as the race has been in existence.
And the race has changed considerably over the years. We've gotten a lot safer. We don't allow front brakes. That was caused a couple little fender benders here and there. But the parent involvement is so cool, especially at night. You can drive around town and you'll see the garage lights on and the garage doors open and people working on their cars. And the theme is sea life. And you can see by the seagulls and the boats and the fishermen and the halibut and all those things like that. It's really creative and it's a fun family thing.
And there they go, and that's close. It's a close call, and Dashy takes first place with Purple Sea Urchin coming up behind.
These days, the top prizes, $500 gift certificates at local businesses this year, are awarded for creativity rather than speed.
Okay, drivers and pit crew, please push your carts off to the side.
But it's still a race, and the carts roll two at a time in each heat, competing against the clock rather than each other. The drivers are determined, excited, and as always, a few rookies look just a little bit scared as they gaze nervously down the starting ramp, waiting for their carts to be released and sent down the gradual slope to glory.
And they're off. This is the final last heat. We have the boat pressure in lane two.
For Only a Game, I'm Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, Alaska.
And here comes the boat pressure out in front. And they got you coming up behind. And there's the boat pressure.
When the NFL's Arizona Cardinals abruptly moved their training camp to Prescott, Arizona this year, many thought it would be the last time a pro football team would encamp in Flagstaff. But it took only a few months for the AFL's Collingwood Magpies to move onto the practice fields at the Center for High Altitude Training, making them the first Australian football team to train in the U.S. After a rare bad year, the Magpies have gone to great lengths, quite literally, to improve. Arizona Public Radio's Mitch Tyke reports.
For Julie Oswald, it was like Wednesday morning fever.
I used to think I wanted to meet John Travolta, but this certainly tops that by a mile.
Oswald is a Canadian. She lives in San Diego, and she's a huge fan of a sport called Australian rules football, and specifically of the Collingwood Magpies, the team that was practicing about 15 feet away from her on a football field at Northern Arizona University.
I'm having heart palpitations.
Oswald became a fan of the sport known as footy when she lived in Australia. She then hooked her husband on it, and the two of them jumped at the chance to drive 8 hours to watch their favorite team practice. Julie and husband Mike are fans of other sports too, but none of them has quite the appeal of footy, a sport they claim is pretty easy to understand.
Basically, get the ball through the big goalposts and...
Any way you can.
Yeah.
Any way you can get it down the field. It's great. It's just so fast-paced. It's just so constant. That's what's fun to watch about it. It's just go, go, go the whole time.
The any way you can aspect makes training for an Australian football season an especially complex endeavor. Players dribble, kick, and bat the ball with their hands down a huge oval-shaped field as the opposing team does nearly anything it can to stop them. A game lasts almost 2 hours, so senior coach Michael Malthouse says conditioning was a large part of the reason the club traveled thousands of miles to train.
Primarily it was to get altitude training at a facility that is recognised in the world for that. So under those circumstances there's very few that parallel Flagstaff, so opportunity to start our pre-season program away from home.
It's actually the pre-preseason. The Magpies are only a couple months removed from the end of their last season, a disappointing one in which they lost their final 8 matches. The team is one of the most popular in Australia, with millions of fans, and so Malthouse says coming all the way to Flagstaff also sends the fans an important message.
They would see this as a progressive step, and I think that crowds are generally unforgiving, but they're reasonably forgiving if they can see that you're taking the right steps. And if people can see that, then they've got something to hang on to. If you don't give them that opportunity, then they get pretty dark and they've got every reason to be.
But Malthouse says if they just traveled all this way to practice, it would have been a waste of money. Coming to Arizona also gave them an uncommon opportunity to bond as a team. They hiked the Grand Canyon together, climbed Humphreys Peak, and created geometric shapes with a rope.
It's basically 14 across.
Right, now who's right up the other end, the original end, up the other end?
The Magpie players are blindfolded as they work on a team-building exercise at the NAU Challenge Course under the tutelage of Maddie Paffenbarger.
Yep, and
two, three.
It's an intellectual approach to geometry and other problem-solving exercises, and it comes as a result of Magpie Management's philosophy that mental strength is as important as physical strength over a long season. Reg Crawford is the team's chief of staff and a former officer in Australia's elite Special Air Services military regiment.
The things that we did today, some of them are a little bit strange, some of them even might seem a little bit silly, but what they are is they're designed to put people in different situations to see how they react and really concentrate on the things that make teamwork happen. Communication, respect, trust, and getting things to work and the team to work through problems together in unfamiliar circumstances, because it's a good way of dealing with pressure in a football situation.
Crawford says doing that 8,200 miles from home was important so the Magpies could concentrate away from the scrutiny of fans and the Melbourne media. That's not to say they were out of touch with their supporters. The team's multimedia manager posted daily video updates on the club's website for their faithful following. They also worked on attracting new fans to footy here in America.
They know all sorts of things about Australia.
We'll test them out. We'll see how much they know.
And that was how three of the Magpies ended up in Mrs. Ziegler's third grade class at DeMiguel Elementary School in Flagstaff, answering questions from kids who have been studying Australia.
How do you play?
With Australian rules football, you can be tackled anywhere, and if you've got the ball, and if he's going to mark the ball, this guy's face this direction, and he takes the ball up high, I can jump into his back, right, and punch the ball away. So I can stick my knees into his back, or the back of his head.
While these third graders are no strangers to knees in the back of the head, there will be few opportunities for them to actually play footy. But Guy Richards, who plays a position called ruckman, says he enjoys being an ambassador of the sport.
It's a little bit different because in Australia we're noticed so much, but you come to Arizona, no one knows who we are, so it's a fair bit different. But it's a good experience to come out here, come out to a school and show them a little bit about the game.
Officials with the Center for High Altitude Training say they're hopeful the Pies will be back again next fall. Magpie Management says that'll depend in part on how the team does in its upcoming season, which begins in April. Already, casual observers in Flagstaff believe the Magpies have just as good a chance of winning the Super Bowl as the Arizona Cardinals. For Only a Game, I'm Mitch Tyke in Flagstaff.
What do we say to our guests?
Thank you!
Give them a round of applause.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR in Boston. Additional support comes from Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting. Available at the Implant Dentistry Center at Bicon.com, BICON.com. And from the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at CabotCheese.com.
I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, America on the Ropes in 1910. And still not off the hook, but first I'm joined by our analyst Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
Some complain that baseball is too slow. Will those complaints be more legitimate than ever on opening day next spring?
Back to long ball and away from speed and defense, I guess, or speed in any case, in a move that was considerably more traumatic to the baseball establishment, or at least the competitive baseball establishment than I thought it would be. Not only did they get tough on steroids, but they also got tough on amphetamines, which are apparently an integral part of the game.
The Baltimore Orioles announced this week that they would not be bringing back Rafael Palmeiro or Sammy Sosa. Gee, you don't think that decision is related to the stricter steroid penalties also implemented this week, do you?
I think it's related to it. I think in Sosa's case, it's more related to the fact he hit 221 with 14 home runs.
Yeah, that'll
this year.
That'll do it. It's not quite holiday shopping season, but Michael Redd, a guard with the Milwaukee Bucks, has already taken care of his dad's gift, and it is a dandy, right?
Yeah, I think this is probably unprecedented, although Pedro Martinez did a similar thing for his hometown in the Dominican Republic. Michael Redd bought his father a church, and a good one, a 500-seat steeple, stained glass windows. You know, James Redd, the father, you know, he says he can't believe it. Apparently this was a promise he made.
That's right.
And good for him.
Pro football players have been known to get into fights. The FBI does not generally become involved. Why are the feds talking to Chicago Bears, Olin Krutz and Fred Miller?
Because apparently the FBI in the Chicago area has been using its shooting range as kind of a Chuck E. Cheese for grown-ups. I didn't know my tax dollars were doing this, but they've been using the shooting range, and two offensive linemen got in a fight. Olin Krutz broke his jaw. There was a barbecue with FBI employees and players. An FBI official on the scene confirmed that alcohol was consumed during the barbecue. But insisted there was no drinking during the target practice.
I'm delayed.
Your tax dollars at work.
Meanwhile, a recent report on what happens to the food you buy at pro football games before it finds its way to you suggests that you should avoid beer, hot dogs, and pretty much everything else sold at the stadium. Exactly who is surprised by this conclusion?
A Green Bay television station got a hold of the county health department records for Lambeau Field, and the results are not pretty. We are looking at a very large 68,000-seat Petri dish up there on the frozen tundra. We have debris in the beer taps. I don't even know what that means. We have utensils considered dirty or, quote, overgrown with mold. I don't think you would have to consider something overgrown with mold. I think it would probably be fairly obvious that something was overgrown
and
with
considering
mold.
Considering it,
it's not a matter of opinion. This thing's green.
Charlie, we've already gotten our pick for NASCAR's championship this weekend, but in your capacity as Mr. NASCAR, I'm wondering if you think it's a good idea, when you're a driver at NASCAR, pulled over for speeding, swerving to avoid a car, running a stop sign, to suggest that the cop is a Jeff Gordon fan.
Kurt Busch, who was pulled over for driving in a fashion frowned upon in polite society, if perhaps not in NASCAR, lipped off to a police officer in Phoenix, claiming you're only doing this because you're a Jeff Gordon fan. He also called the deputies a joke, and he also used the all-purpose athlete alibi. Do you know who I am?
Always a successful one.
To which the officer, if he had a lick of humor in him, said, yes, you're a dope who thinks I'm a Jeff Gordon fan.
John McEnroe may soon have another reason to throw a temper tantrum, courtesy of Roger Federer. Or do you suppose Mr. McEnroe will graciously congratulate Mr. Federer if he snatches away the record for best winning percentage in a tennis season?
I think he will graciously, because John has matured, point out that it was a lot tougher in his day.
There you go.
But Federer is 80-3. He's two wins shy of John McEnroe's record for the Open era which was 82-3, the best winning percentage in the season. It seems very unlikely that McEnroe's record will stand. Federer is better than anybody in the world right now.
Florida State University got its national championship trophies back this week. Charlie, I guess the people who had them found that there was a very limited market for easily identifiable, obviously stolen national championship trophies.
Well, I think the other thing that happens is when artwork is stolen, generally, the feeling is that it's being stolen for foreign collectors who then hang, you know, the Scream up in their pool room in the basement in, you know, Osaka or Beijing or Lapland or someplace. Nobody else in the world wants American college football trophies. Nobody else in the world knows what they are. It looks Florida like, State what?
It looks like the LPGA may finally have the beginnings of a rivalry involving your favorite and mine, Annika Sörenstam.
Annika Sörenstam and Paula Creamer got into a wrangle about whether or not Sörenstam should have taken a drop on the 18th fairway. And apparently the argument went so long that it was almost too dark to finish. I think, you know, Paula Creamer has decided that, you know, anything Annika wants, Annika is not going to get on the LPGA Tour. And I think there's only a matter of time before they both start mouthing off about Michelle Wee anyway. So yeah. It's good to have a little thing to tide us over until then.
It works in WWE. Dutch organizers of a bid for the world record in domino toppling, a sport with which I admit I was unfamiliar until this week, had to hire extra security after death threats and sabotage attempts. When did the world of domino toppling become such a flashpoint for controversy?
Well, apparently a sparrow came through and had roughly the same amount of respect for the sport of domino toppling as you and I have and knocked down 23,000 of them, and somebody killed them. And now the animal rights people in Holland are outraged and are threatening the person who shot the sparrow, who knocked down the dominoes, who ate the fly, and why did he ate the fly? I don't know why. Perhaps he'll die.
And finally, Charlie, did you see any headline in the sports news this week more remarkable than Tyson dinner ends in mass brawl?
The police were called to, quote, a large fight at the Heritage Hotel in Derby. 20 people involved in the brawl, which saw chairs hurled, tables tipped over, glasses smashed, and punches thrown. And I can tell you for a fact, it's the first time the name Mike Tyson has been associated with the words large fight in about 10 years.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine. He joins me each week at this time here on Only a Game. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
You can share your comments with Only a Game by writing to us, care of WBUR-FM, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215, or by emailing oag@wbur.bu.edu. The 1910 heavyweight fight between Jack Johnson and Jim Jeffries was remarkable for several reasons. Jeffries, who had retired undefeated 5 years previously, claimed he was still the legitimate champion. Johnson had won the championship in the ring. Jeffries only took the fight because author Jack London and much of the public at large so energetically beseeched him to remove the heavyweight crown from the black champion's head. The fight itself was terrible in its brutality and significant for its consequences, short-term and long, so maintains Wayne A. Rosen, the author of America on the Ropes, a pictorial history of the Johnson-Jeffries fight, which is actually an ambitious and sizable compilation of cartoons, editorials, and contemporary accounts, as well as a chronicle of the bout. Wayne Rosen joins me now from the studios of WSKG in Binghamton, New York. Welcome to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
8 pounds this book weighs. This is quite a project.
The book is a heavyweight, as it should be for a heavyweight championship fight.
Some of the most revealing pictures in this pictorial history are of both fighters before the bout. Jack Johnson looks strong and confident. I'm thinking of one particular photo where he has his arms folded across his chest. Jim Jeffries, on the other hand, often looks as if he'd rather be somewhere else than in his boxing togs. Why did so few alleged experts think that Johnson would win?
Well, from a purely boxing standpoint, those few who really looked at the fight without any racial aspects saw that Johnson would be a clear winner. But everybody who looked at this didn't look at the fight with their head. They looked at it with their heart. And that's a problem. And in those days, 1910, it was a racial heart. So everybody was more interested in getting that heavyweight crown, which was the most cherished of all the athletic championships, off a black head and back onto a white one where they felt it rightly belonged.
When he was champion, Jim Jeffries would not fight a black man. He was representative of white champions in that regard. Tell us a little bit about what lured him out of retirement to fight Jack Johnson.
Well, what lured him out, I think, even more than the racial challenge that was issued by Jack London in that very famous piece he wrote from Sydney, Australia, when Johnson beat Tommy Burns for the title. He issued that challenge, you have to knock the golden smile off of Johnson's face. Jeffries was a pretty realistic guy, and he also realized he'd make more money in this fight than he would probably throughout most of his career. And he went into boxing for the money. He was never a great lover of the sport. He was a gifted athlete. He was a 6'2", 230 pounds, could run the 100-yard dash in under 11 seconds. He was more like a linebacker today in pro football or college football. But he wanted the money, and he felt with this fight and with all the action and energy surrounding the fight, he couldn't miss, and he didn't.
There are numbers of photographs of Jack Johnson regaling boxing writers, and they are described in one article as, quote, in good humor and won over by the champion. But the cartoons running in the papers at the same time present a very different story, don't they, particularly the ones by a cartoonist named Goldberg.
Yes, Rube Goldberg, who was famous, of course, for his contraptions in his later cartooning. He and Robert Ripley, who started Ripley's Believe It or Not, were both early sports cartoonists. They started their drawing careers as sports cartoonists. And I think Goldberg really represents accurately the flavor of the time. Now, 1910 in the United States, America was still feeling its energy. It was growing. You had Vanderbilt, J.P. Morgan, Carnegie. Everybody was making a fortune. All the advancements, the technical advancements were terrific. And everything was great in this country unless you were black. Mm. And that really is the focus of the whole fight, is that black-white issue. And that's what made the fight so important sociologically as well as athletically.
Just to give our listeners a picture of these cartoons as we're talking about them, Johnson is invariably portrayed as having a huge flat nose, gigantic oversized lips, all of these qualities vastly exaggerated for the, the merriment and delight of sports readers.
Yeah, that's what all the cartooning looked like at that time. And, you know, it's very easy and tempting to say that everybody who drew it, they were racist. I really don't quite see it that way. I think racism at that time was accepted. It certainly wasn't right. On any grounds, it wasn't right. Some of the most famous songs of the day were "All Coons Look Alike to Me," mm-hmm. "Coon, Coon, Coon, Stay in Your Own Backyard." I mean, really rough stuff. And it was a rough time. It was the nadir of race relations.
Racism accounted in part for the desire to see Jack Johnson defeated in the ring, as you have discussed. It also explained why he was persecuted under the Mann Act and eventually convicted and jailed. But within the context of the fight against Jim Jeffries, it seems that Jack Johnson fared better than in the context of the nation at large. When he arrived in Reno for the fight, for example, you write that his reception was, quote, enthusiastic and respectful. I wonder if he felt encouraged, as if he was making a difference in terms of race relations.
I don't think race relations really meant that much to Jack Johnson. Jack Johnson, in today's words, did his own thing when doing your own thing was certainly unheard of. He accepted things as they were and then went about and did his own thing anyway. His dating of white women, especially white sporting women, was so against the social mores of that time. But that never stopped Jack Johnson.
And by sporting women, at this point, we don't mean female tennis players and golfers. We mean women who were prostitutes in this case.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And wherever Jack went, wherever Johnson went with a woman on his arm, the woman was always referred to in the newspaper coverage as his wife. So he was seen with a certain wife in Australia, a certain wife in New Zealand, a certain wife in Vancouver, and a certain wife in Reno.
The sort of racism evident in the commentary, sports writing, and cartoons that you include in your book was very much of a particular time and a particular place. But you maintain that, quote, race and boxing are still an explosive combination. How so?
Probably the last racially tinged fight of any real note was when Larry Holmes fought Jerry Cooney, and Holmes referred to Cooney as a white hope for white dopes. that was a big deal, and the racial aspect, of course, is what draws the money. That's what makes the average Joe, who's not a boxing fan, plunk down the money to watch it pay per view. Even Ali, Muhammad Ali, in his fight against Joe Frazier in 1971, made that into a racial battle, referring to himself as the independent black and referring to Frazier as the Uncle Tom black, here taking two black athletes and making race an issue between the two of them. Then, of course, you went back to the famous Lewis Schmeling fight, where race was paramount with the Nazi menace and Lewis. But Lewis was told to behave in a certain manner so he would get acceptance from white America. And that, of course, came back to Jack Johnson. That Johnson, once Johnson was defeated in 1915, it took over 22 years before another black, Joe Lewis, was allowed, just allowed, to get in the ring and fight for the heavyweight championship.
Strikes me now, though, that the use of race in promoting fights is much more cynical because we do live in a different time, and so it's Hispanic against black, for example, not necessarily white against black, and there's a kind of cynicism in the promotion that perhaps was not so clear 100 years ago.
Well, I think, and this is probably the wrong word to use, but I think 100 years ago it was more honest, if you can insult the word that way, because that's really 100 years ago how the country was. It was a white country, and it was not a black country, and it wasn't even looked at as a partially black country. So what you got there was really the honesty of how bad the times were.
Wayne Rosen is the author of America on the Ropes, A Pictorial History of the Johnson-Jeffries Fight, published by Casey Press. Wayne, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure, Bill. Thanks very much. And when you pick up that book, make sure you're secured all the way so you don't get a hernia. I don't want that on my conscience.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Perotti. We had help this week from Greg Fazio and from Ken Campbell at WSKG in Binghamton, New York. Our senior producer is Gary Wallet. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to read a review of America on the Ropes, see photos and cartoons from the book, or check out the Purple Princess Sea Urchin, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Major League Baseball Commissioner Bud Selig as he evaluates the league's new drug policy.
It had quite a profound effect on me, I don't mind telling you. So, it's a great story.
Well, Mr. Commissioner, I think you'd better let us be the judge of that. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, from NPR member stations, from the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, on the web at wkkf.org, and from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.